Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for the Doctors Roundtable, a forum for conversations with Atlanta's leading doctors and thought leaders about cutting-edge trends and topics in health, wellness, and lifestyle issues. Here's our host, Tanya Mack.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for dialing in with us today and listening. Today, it is a beautiful sunny day in Atlanta, and we have a beautiful sunny guest with us today. If you live in Atlanta, we're going to be talking about a women's health issue today, and you know that Northside Hospital and those around there are ground central for what's happening in women's health in the city of Atlanta. And my guest today is Dr. Jennifer Elliott from Women's Health Associates. Welcome, Dr. Elliott.
Well, thank you.
And let me tell you a little bit about her. She got her medical degree from LSU School of Medicine in New Orleans and moved to Atlanta and completed her residency at Atlanta Medical Center. And then worked in private practice out in Carrollton, Georgia, and recently moved back into town and joined Women's Health Associates in July of 2012. She does gynecology only now and has given up your obstetric midnight calls. Is that right?
That's right.
A little better lifestyle for sure. Mm-hmm. And was named one of the top docs by Lifestyle Magazine. So we're thrilled to have you here. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
And one of the places I always like to start is just tell us a little bit about your road to OBGYN and kind of the path you chose and why. I always think it's an interesting way to start.
Yeah, I often get that question. Why in the world would you want to do this for my patients? I knew for a while I wanted to be a doctor and growing up. And when I started medical school, it was tough because I just liked all of the fields. I knew I loved surgery, but I also wanted to have some kind of personal connection with my patients. So that led me to OBGYN because I thought it was a good...
It's a good mix.
Yeah, it's a good mix of all of it. So... Anyway, and then I loved delivering babies for a while, but eventually wanted to just find a focus on what I felt like my strengths were, which were GYN surgery and particularly minimally invasive procedures that came out over the last 5 or so years.
Mm-hmm. We're doing a lot more in-office, too.
A lot more.
Yeah, with, you know, we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll kind of work that into the conversation. So really today we're talking about urinary incontinence, overactive bladder. I know it is a problem for a lot of women, and probably their gynecologist is one of the very few people they'll ever talk to about that topic. Would you agree?
So true.
And a lot of times, even then, they're embarrassed to bring it up, and it kind of hinders what could be very correctable problems sometimes.
Yeah, I think often it's really about 1 in 3 women over the age of 40 are affected. And so we tend to tease it out more in our office. My partner and I, and Dr. Kelly Dobson, she's a fantastic urogynecologist. We tend to gear our questions more to so they feel comfortable about that and know that they're not alone and that there are actually are things that you can do.
Mm-hmm. Do you do any screening since you know that a lot of times women won't bring it up during their annual exam? Do you ask questions about that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think often if you don't ask, they're not going to tell. Like you said, people are embarrassed and think there's nothing really that you can do about it anyway. But we try to screen through those.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about just urinary incontinence in general. I know there's urge incontinence, there's stress incontinence. So just kind of clue us in on the basics.
Yeah, often you've probably had several friends that complain about this. One of the more common types of urinary incontinence is stress urinary incontinence. And that's whenever you leak, when you laugh, cough, sneeze, exercise. You don't see too many mothers at the trampoline places getting on the trampoline because they
especially
leak.
Especially post-childbirth, maybe.
Exactly.
Yes.
The moms don't usually get up there. Mm-hmm. But and often in my workout classes, I almost want to pass out my card when I see people, when you start doing the jumping jacks, they'll stop and you can almost guarantee that they're the ones that are leaking. Mm-hmm. So that's more of an anatomy problem with their bladder, where the neck of the bladder, where the sphincter is to close off urine, is kind of past the pubic bone. So instead of being a part of the pelvic floor that gets the equal pressure at the top of the bladder and the neck of the bladder to close it off, it's because it's outside the abdomen, it doesn't get that extra pressure to close. So that's more of an anatomical problem that either biofeedback therapy, exercises, or sling procedures fix.
Mm-hmm.
The other main type is urge incontinence that you were alluding to earlier, are the overactive bladder. And that's, you know, like from the commercials, gotta go, gotta go. Mm-hmm. kind of problems where you feel urgency that you have to urinate and you don't quite have as much time as you used to get to the bathroom before you might have an accident. And often it's accompanied by frequency during the day and feeling like you're not completely emptying all the time and getting up a few times at night.
Mm-hmm. So there's volume issues, there's sphincter issues, just kind of going down the anatomy from really we're talking about the lower urinary tract system, bladder, sphincters, and then...
Yeah, but often overactive bladder starts from, you know, there's a connection from the brain down the spinal cord to the bladder, and sometimes it's a problem with the spinal cord.
Okay, so mm-hmm. it may not be right in the urinary tract system itself, so mm-hmm. you have to look at everything. So what are the most common causes? I was reading before the show that for urinary incontinence, a lot of times it's not common in younger women. But as we age, as gravity takes over, as we have babies, things kind of change and it becomes more prevalent around menopause.
Correct. So age for sure is a common risk factor. Also lack of estrogen. You probably read that in your findings, and that's mm-hmm. why menopause, you'll see a lot more. The tissues kind of atrophy and the strength of the tissues in the pelvic floor aren't as good. Childbirth is probably a huge, one of the hugest risk factors, because you're getting injury to your pelvic floor and the nerves that lead to it as well.
It seems like we don't have, like, I'm just thinking back when I had my kids, I really didn't feel much different in the years right after their birth. But the older that you get, is it just the atrophy though?
That's true. And then okay. a lot of the damage that you have compensatory mechanisms when okay. you're younger. And then when that estrogen's
slows
lacking.
Slows down.
Mm-hmm. So I know I think every day, thank God I was, you know, not as damaged as some women, but then I'm not counting my chickens at mm-hmm. all. Because 10 more years in menopause, I think I'll... Just about everybody will see a difference then. Mm-hmm. Also, certain diseases can increase your risk for urinary incontinence, like diabetes, and multiple sclerosis is a big one. Mm-hmm. In fact, some people will get diagnosed with multiple sclerosis from urinary incontinence being one of the first symptoms.
Interesting. I wouldn't have thought that that would be one of the first picked up, but it makes sense to me because mm-hmm. really it's just the pathway and losing control a little bit.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So one of the first things that you see. So, what about overactive bladder? Is that just the urge to go talking that you're talking about, or is that something totally different?
It's a lot of those are interchangeable terms,
okay.
overactive bladder and urge incontinence. I think some people call overactive bladder anything with urinary frequency, urgency, with or without the incontinence part. And then the urge incontinence is when you actually start not being able to control it as well.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about some of the symptoms. Like, because we know it's one thing if you cough and you leak, it's another thing when it becomes like a regular thing.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some things where we see early kind of symptoms, and then where would we see, hey, it's time to see the pro?
Mm-hmm. I often find that there's certain cues that I ask women. If they know where every bathroom in Atlanta is on their way home, that's a clue that you might need to start investigating what you can do about that. Mapping out bathrooms is big. Also, I feel like a lot of people will say, right when I put the key in the door when I get home, I feel like I got to run.
The run.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Or running water will make them start having a lot of urgency. Mm-hmm. It's a strange brain to bladder connection that that happens with people with overactive bladder. A lot of people, it starts with right when they put their feet on the ground when they get up in the morning, and then they better have a close bathroom or they're not going to make it. So those are all things, or people, they often call it the teacher's bladder or nurse's bladder, where you're so used to holding your urine all day because you don't have time to go to the bathroom and you can't go at will. They find that they used to be able to hold it for a long time, and now they can't.
And now the time is decreasing.
Exactly.
So that would be a different clue to them, but the same issue for them.
Exactly.
Okay, very good. So if we have these things and we come to you, we think we have some of the urgency issues or increasing frequency, what kind of happens on our first visit with you?
The first thing we have to figure out is how much is this affecting your lifestyle? Is this bothering you? Are you having to wear pads? Are you stopping functions that you used to go to because it's too embarrassing? Are you having to wear dark clothes now instead of whatever you want to wear? It really depends on how much it's affecting you is what we usually go by how much treatment you need. So often if it's the beginning signs, we go through some lifestyle changes they can do to help improve their symptoms and keep it from progressing. such as I'm sure you've heard of Kegel exercises, mm-hmm. pelvic floor exercises. So we try to teach them how to do that more effectively, and give them a handout on how to do that.
So if I started doing those, how long would it be if I was compliant with the program that I would start to see some improvement?
You know, it varies person to person. If you have, it depends on how severe your damage is. Sometimes they're going to work, and they're going to work great within just a couple of weeks. And often if it's not working in 6 weeks, it's probably not going to work. We need to move on the treatment.
All right. So there's a pretty quick turnaround time on if that treatment is going to be.
Yeah, but
helpful.
Any woman can benefit from it, from just preventing it from mm-hmm. progressing. But it's just like going to the gym, though, and any muscle you work out, you're going to have to be very diligent and consistent with it to see the results.
Mm-hmm. I know when I was in nursing school, they always told us, every stop sign, do your Kegels. I mean, tie it to, like, take your birth control pills and you brush your teeth, making it regular at some point that it triggers you to do them.
Right. And I think just about anybody in this field, any professional would say, you really have to start that well before it becomes a big problem for it mm-hmm. to be the best benefit.
Okay, very good. So what else would happen? If it's more severe than just the lifestyle changes, then what would start? Would we start urodynamic testing then, or would there be other things you'd rule out?
If it's obvious overactive bladder symptoms and signs, oftentimes we would try a medication first before we go on to urodynamic testing. Mm-hmm. Because they're effective probably 40% of the time when it's mild to moderate
so
urgency.
How would the medications work? Would they be like what is the mechanism that they act, the pharmacokinetics of that?
Yeah, well, there's a few different main types of those bladder medications. And the ones you see a lot of commercials about, they work by calming down the spasms of the bladder. So some of the side effects on them, however, works on they're anticholinergics in general is what we call them. So the problem with those is they calm it down and they tend to keep you drier. However, they also can make you have dry mouth, dry eyes, and constipation. Mm-hmm. So which they've gotten more and more selective to the particular receptors of the bladder, but that is some of the risk factors you run with some of those medications. There's a new one that I think a lot of us are starting to really see some big improvement with. It's a beta agonist that's very particular to the receptors of the bladder that don't tend to make you have dry mouth or dry eyes. And it's more about letting the bladder relax when it should, and you're able to empty your bladder better. So a lot of overactive bladder people don't empty their bladder effectively, so that's making them have more frequency and urgency. So it's actually working on a different mechanism. So we have a couple of options medication-wise to try first. And then if that doesn't work, or they may have mixed incontinence, what we call mixed, where they have some component of stress, some component of urge, then we recommend that we go ahead and do the urodynamic testing to better pinpoint what's going to work well for them.
Okay, so as far as symptoms we've talked about leakage, we've talked about frequency of urination, we've talked about sudden urges, and we've talked about problems with starting or stopping a stream. What about recurrent UTIs? Would that be kind of something that might be a clue that there's something going on?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or something to be checked out by
again,
a doctor?
Absolutely. That always warrants further workup. That's why when people call in and say, I have another UTI, just call me in something, we're very particular about having you come in, especially if it's not your first or second. So we actually want to run a culture.
For a reason.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And culture that and make sure it's truly a UTI. And then also if it's been documented, figure out why that is. And it might be because they're not emptying their bladder and it's staying stagnant.
Okay, so let's get into, we think there's a problem. We've tried the lifestyle. We've tried the medication. We aren't getting the results that you need. So let's talk a little bit about urodynamic testing. So kind of just give us an overview of that, and then we'll talk about some specific tests.
Okay, great. Well, it sounds scary, and I think that's probably people's biggest trepidation of even mentioning urinary incontinence because they might have heard what needs to be done. But basically, we have the patient come in with a full bladder and try to be off of her medications that she might have been trying before then because we don't want to skew the test.
How long is it fast, a couple days, a day, a week? How long are they off their meds usually?
I usually say 2 weeks. Okay. Just to make sure it's completely out of their system.
Okay.
So they come in with a full bladder, and we have them pee over a special toilet that measures the flow and the pattern of flow. And then the nurse who is specialized in that in doing the, administering these tests, and she usually is the type that really makes you feel very comfortable. She inserts a little tube into the urethra, into the bladder, and we see how much urine is left. And that gives us an idea if they're emptying or not. That, it's called the post-void residual we're looking for. Then we use that same catheter along with a little small probe in the rectum. We fill the bladder up at different levels with a sterile solution, and we have her strain or cough at different volumes, again looking for the stress incontinence and at what volume and pressure she would leak at.
So does it actually measure actual pressures?
It does. It's called a leak point pressure.
Okay.
So it's measuring the pressure in the bladder. And that's the reason for the rectal probe. We're trying to subtract the abdominal pressure, and that's kind of how we
gauge
that.
So you get the net effect
that.
On the bladder itself.
Exactly.
Not pelvic area total. Okay.
Exactly. And then there's another catheter that we use at the end for the urethral pressure, too. And so it's all a calculation on where the problem is. But we try to see if the bladder's contracting when it's not supposed to be, kind of unsolicited contractions. That would be more consistent with the overactive bladder. Or whether it's just with extra intra-abdominal pressure like coughing, sneezing, laughing. So it gives us a lot of good ideas if it's a nerve problem, muscle problem, anatomy problem, at what pressure is the problem and what volume, so we can better determine how aggressive we're going to get with the treatment.
So this sounds like a really long appointment. Do you do some of these tests per patient as indicated? Do you do a number of them typically in a visit?
Well, what we do is we identify who needs them. Then if they need to be scheduled for them, we give them information on how it's done, and we have our scheduler work with them and check on their insurance first. I work with a company, I don't know if I'm allowed to mention it.
You are.
Okay, Bladder Health Network, and very reputable company that I think does a great job at everybody that administers the test. All of the nurses are very well trained, and that's all they do. So we try to stack them on the same day. We do them all anywhere from 2 to 8 on the same day, and they usually last 45 minutes on average, each patient. And so that way, and then we get a good printout, and I email a copy of the results to a urogynecologist from Duke that I really trust as well. And any of them that I have concerns about or they're a little tricky or complicated, I get his opinion on it. So that's the benefit of using that company.
Now, when I'm hearing you do that, I'm just squeezing my legs together over here in the other seat, and I'm starting to wonder, like, how bad is this going to hurt me? Is there anesthesia involved? Is there... on a scale of 1 to 10, typically, what can you expect?
Yeah, I know you're just going to run out and come see me at the office right now after. It does sound awful, doesn't it? But it's most people say it's uncomfortable and slightly embarrassing, but it's not painful.
Okay, so there's not sharp pains or anything. Probably just fullness and
maybe
a little tenderness.
Fullness, feeling like you have to urinate by the end, and you know, a little discomfort and you know, like any patient, I'm sure what is kind of embarrassed to, they don't actually want to leak in front of you. But our biggest advice is to try not to feel like, you know, this is an embarrassing thing. This is what we want you to do. We're trying to recreate what you're doing in real life so that you won't be embarrassed in real life.
Right. So it's a little bit of pain today, not pain, but uncomfortableness for a big change maybe in your quality
of life. Exactly. And if we didn't think it was important, we wouldn't put people through it. But I think that's where a lot of the problems in the media came from, the criticisms of these kind of procedures, is that people didn't really go through the true steps to confirm exactly where the problem was before they tried to address it.
And so there's no anesthesia, there's no knocking out. It's something you do in the office, not the hospital generally?
Correct.
Okay, so it's very doable in a couple of hours. You have a lot of the information that you need.
Absolutely.
Okay, all right, very good. So sounds scary, but women, process you got to go through to get done. Now, are there any risks to the procedures?
It can increase the risk for a current urinary tract infection because you are placing things in the bladder. But we give a preventative dose of antibiotics and give you some instructions on clearing your bladder and urinating a lot afterwards. And that's minimal. And you might be a little crampy for 30 minutes to an hour afterwards, but after that, it's no problem.
Okay, so as far as recovery, I can go back to work the next day. I'm fine. I'll be
absolutely.
You just kind of mm-hmm. fall right back into it. No big deal there. And it sounds like the only special preparation is just go off any meds that you were,
mm-hmm.
Come in and start with a full bladder, and then you go from there. So it sounds like not mm-hmm. the same as a colonoscopy or something that. Nothing that complicated.
No prep.
Okay, very, very good. So we've talked a little bit about the test. Now, we get the test results back. Tell us a little bit about what's normal, what's not, what you're looking for, and then we'll talk about some treatments from what you see.
Yeah, so not to get too technical about it, but if it's stress urinary incontinence, we're looking at, like we were talking about, the leak point pressures.
Right.
At what pressure do you leak at? What volume? Because there's a couple of different types of stress incontinence. So regular genuine stress incontinence is we give options of treatment that are less invasive, like maybe some biofeedback therapy with a therapist, further Kegel exercises. And honestly, most of the time we offer people a outpatient surgery to fix it if they don't want to go through the intensive treatments that would be required to get to improve it. But we give people those options. If they have something called intrinsic sphincter deficiency, where their urethra doesn't close very well, sometimes it's called a stovepipe urethra, if you can imagine that. That may help you a little bit get the concept mm-hmm. that it doesn't want to kind of close. It's kind of like mm-hmm. a tube. That requires a little different type of procedure that's a little bit more invasive than the prior one. But so it does really give us some good useful information about which one of those procedures they would qualify for. So then if it's overactive bladder, where we can tell they're contracting when they're not supposed to, their bladder isn't emptying as well. There's some nerve responses that are a little different. Then that's a long slew of different things we can do, like we talked about, the medications, the lifestyle. And finally, ones that are very severe, there's a procedure called an InterStim neuromodulator mm-hmm. procedure.
So tell us about that.
It sounds a little scary, but it also sounds like voodoo, but it works great. It's a I'm from Louisiana, you know.
Yeah,
use voodoo.
Big voodoo.
Right. So it's
I've been to Bourbon Street.
Yeah.
The lady at the end scares me too.
Well, anyway, it's a surgery where we implant a little small transmitter under the skin, in the lower part of the back. And the transmitter sends a little mild electrical pulses through a tiny wire to the nerves that lead to the bladder. These are painless little pulses that try to kind of interrupt those mixed messages that you get that warrant bladder contractions. So we're trying to kind of interrupt, almost like a TENS unit for back.
Okay, but it's implanted.
It is. It's implanted. So before we commit to the permanent transmitter, we do a little test in the office called a percutaneous test, mm-hmm. where we do little temporary leads, little wires. Again, sounds scary, but not under anesthesia, just some local pain medicine. Mm-hmm. And we put a little wire to that nerve that helps control the pelvic floor. Mm-hmm. And we hook it up to a little temporary stimulator that looks like a little beeper. Mm-hmm. And they wear it around for about 5 days, keep a diary before and after. We do one on each side, then they come back in 5 days later. During that time, they can't take a bath or shower. They have mm-hmm. to kind of sponge off because it's mm-hmm. electrical energy, so we don't want mm-hmm. any problems to occur. And they have to kind of take it easy so the wires don't move. Mm-hmm. But then when they come out, we pull out the temporary wires and review their diary with them. If they get a better than 50% improvement, then
they
we go.
They might be a candidate.
Exactly. And what I usually do is I say, well, how'd you do? And they either say, oh, I'm not so sure if it helped me or not, or they say, I want this done tomorrow. I think it's very decisive, and usually it's a life changer. They're wanting to run and get it immediately. You can ask my scheduler. They're very excited about it because it's been affecting, if they really need that procedure, mm-hmm. it's been affecting their life so much that they are really excited that they can finally, if they can tell they're going to be able to live again.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this something that the idea is retraining or they'll have for the rest of their life?
They're going to have it for the rest of their life.
Okay.
It's a little battery that the permanent one goes under the skin, kind of like a pacemaker. In fact, the same company that makes pacemakers manufacture this as well. And so the permanent lead goes under the skin and connects to the permanent battery. And the battery is the only part that needs to be changed out periodically. They last about 5 years, depending on how much amplitude we have to use and voltage. But we that's a little simple outpatient changing out of the battery every 3 to 7 years, average 5.
Okay, so really it's once you get it in there, you're pretty maintenance-free for a very long time.
Occasionally we have to reprogram them and do a little different maneuvers with them, but most of the time it is.
Okay. Yeah. And it sounds like inside of your office you have support staff or specially trained nurses that help you with these procedures and pretty much do things like InterStim or your dynamic testing.
Right, right. It's a good thing about our office. My partner does a great job with pelvic floor prolapse, which is often the cause of all of these problems. She does it. We've gotten to where we're kind of specialized in certain areas, and that's one of the reasons I joined them. Is she's fantastic at that, and then anybody that she feels needs this procedure, I do those.
So we're kind of heading from treatments to surgery. This is kind of an outpatient surgery. Now, do you as part of your training, urogynecology is almost like a special set of procedures outside of gynecology. Have you done extra work or to work with things like InterStim, do you have to have special training?
Well, you know, I went to a weekend course. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, of course, there's a lot of extra training. I got more interested in it when more of these minimally invasive things became available. And when I was in small town Georgia, you know, I probably got more training than the typical a regular gynecologist did, because I could tell from the papers and the research that it was really successful, and I didn't want my patients to not get those kind of treatments. So I did go to several courses over the years, and I've been doing InterStim for about 7 years now and had great success. A lot of places, particularly around Northside, a lot of the urologists do it too, of course, and that is their forte. But yeah, I feel really comfortable with doing these kind of things. And there is a lot of extra special training if you want to kind of specialize in the urogynecology type field. And luckily, this InterStim procedure, which again sounds kind of odd, but it's just been approved for fecal incontinence as well. And actually, it has even better percentage cure rates for fecal incontinence than it does for urinary. It's all related to pelvic floor dysfunction.
And the innervation to the pelvic floor.
Exactly.
It's
a sacral nerve.
Yeah, kind of an impulse-based kind of thing. So of the patients that you see from the ones you come in and evaluate, how many, can you give us any thought on how many patients are successfully treated with lifestyle? As a group, how many are by medication, and then how many end up being surgical intervention?
Well, again, we you know, even though we're trained to do all of these fancy things, we really do try to start off with the less invasive thing.
Right, and progress.
And progress. And we let the patient tell us, you know, how aggressive do you want to get with these different treatments? So a lot of lifestyle stuff, I think that really helps. And we didn't talk about dietary avoidances, but if you do timed voiding during the day, every 2 to 3 hours, whether you think you need to go or not, really helps keep your bladder normal capacity and better compliance and your nerves working better. And then avoiding certain things in your diet, caffeine, carbonated drinks, spicy foods, citrus fruits and juices, anything acidic, tomato-based products. If you do that in the exercises, that helps a lot of people enough to where they're saying, okay, you know, I still have some problems here and there, but they're less frequently.
Manageable.
They're manageable.
What about fluid intake? Like, do you say don't drink after what time at night? So you're not.
Yeah. I usually say if you cannot drink after 6 p.m., that's great. Now, that's a little hard to do.
No, that'd be hard for me to do.
That's hard to do. But if you have a major problem getting up a lot at night, I think that really helps a lot of people. And all these diets now where you're drinking like 3 gallons of water a day. I mean, everyone's like, I got to drink more water. But that's really not that great for your bladder.
Right.
You probably read that in your reading. Right. You really don't need near as much as you thought you did. But especially at night if you have that problem.
Okay. All right. Now let's go into, we've talked about lifestyle. We've talked about medications. We've talked about some of the treatments. Like any other treatments like InterStim that's a outpatient thing?
Yeah, there's for overactive bladder, there's also something called a tibial nerve stimulator that you may have read about, where you have to come for weekly treatments, and it there's little stimulators that we place around the ankle area and calf, and it's usually a weekly treatment for about 12 weeks. Now, that the only dilemma with that one, it's kind of a maintenance thing. You have to kind of go periodically and get that done, and it's got a good success rate, but not quite as good as the InterStim stimulator.
So is the idea that you're retraining through the stimulation? It's like forced exercise of
You're kind of interrupting those wrong pulses. And a lot of this stuff, we're not 100% sure why it works, you know, so it's kind of a work in progress. But the tibial nerve stimulator is an option for people. Another new option, which, you know, more and more people are starting to get trained on, is Botox injections in the bladder.
Interesting. Okay. So
that's looking very promising.
Is it?
So,
and the thought is just for overactive bladder, just minimize that muscle, same as if I injected in my worry blinds in my forehead. Just
exactly.
Take it out.
Like they're starting to do for migraines, for different muscles for migraines.
So is that surgical?
It is surgical, but just outpatient. Okay. I mean, you have to go through a cystoscope, which I can envision in the future being able to be done in the office through a cystoscope in the office. But right now
we're starting with GYN surgeries and ablations and things like that being done in the office more and more moving.
Correct, yeah.
Back to the InterStim. One, I hate to dwell on this, but it's just so fascinating
me. It's fascinating.
Can I feel that little zapper? Like if it's sending a pulse down and you're implanting it, what can I feel?
Well, we want you to feel a certain kind of sensation when we're placing it. And that's how we can tell if we're placing it in the correct place. Mm-hmm. So we go by both motor and sensory. So we're trying to get you to feel a little like most people describe it as a flutter in their vaginal area.
Okay.
And between the vagina and rectum and perineum, kind of like anywhere on the bike seat where you sit on a bike. Mm-hmm. So it feels kind of strange to people at first when they first start feeling
but
it.
But they just get used to it.
But your brain gets used to it and pretty soon you don't feel it at all. Are you very, you don't even really notice it after a while.
Okay. All right. Now let's wrap up here with the surgical interventions that are more common than the outpatient. I know certainly you've mentioned pelvic floor damage and we've talked about some of the procedures you do, but what are some of the common, they're not common, I guess they're extreme, but in the surgical realm, somebody that really has to have surgical intervention, what would be some procedures that they might be facing?
Well, for the stress incontinence, we talked about slings, and those are outpatient procedures where we make a little small incision under the urethra, where the urine comes out, and make like almost like a little hammock of a material that's kind of holding up the bladder neck, kind of behind that pubic bone. So again, it's more of an intra-abdominal.
That's for the treatment for the prolapse?
For stress incontinence.
Okay.
So for prolapse, there's several different surgeries for that, and it really depends on where the prolapse is occurring mostly. But some of those can be done through the vagina on an outpatient basis, and some of those have to be done laparoscopically or through the robotic surgery. But those are, it's a pretty complicated field where you really have to do a lot of that.
Pelvic surgery.
Yes.
Keep your pelvic surgery skills up.
Oh, yeah. It's pretty technical. And again, my partner, Dr. Dobson, that's her expertise. Mm-hmm. She's really good at that.
Mm-hmm. How many of your surgeries are you doing, GYN and urogyne related, are robotic these days?
It's rare that we have to make an abdominal incision anymore. It's so most of them we try to do. I probably do in-office hysteroscopy. You talked about ablations and Eschers. Mm-hmm. I probably do about four of those a month. And then in the OR, I probably do just about all of my hysterectomies are robotic, even when they're really large, large uteri. Mm-hmm. If they're more than a 6-week pregnancy, we have to do it open. Mm-hmm. But other than that, we usually can do it less invasively, laparoscopically or robotically or vaginally. Mm-hmm. Even taking out fibroids. We were just talking about this morning, I took out fibroids through the robot. And even a few years ago, we would have had to open for that. And it's just come a long way.
So technology's, changing a lot of recoveries.
It is.
Yeah, and your skill set, too.
Sure,
A lot to keep on learning as technology changes.
Exactly.
Very good. One of the things we talked about off air, but I want to talk about it on air, is I know a lot of women have problems with endometriosis. Mm-hmm. And in the course of researching the show, I know it kind of invades everywhere. So I wanted to ask you, is endometriosis linked, or how might it be linked to urinary incontinence?
Yeah, people who have severe endometriosis, particularly stage 4 endometriosis, where it's you know, stuck to their bowel, in their bladder, that's when it can be affecting the function. Because again, it, you know, you have pain from endometriosis, mm-hmm. affecting the nerves. It's not super common for it to, it's actually fairly rare for it to be a true cause of incontinence. But you know, if it is causing bladder problems, you probably have it pretty severe. Mm-hmm. And usually, along with surgery, would probably have to need some medication to help mm-hmm. cause regression. Because mm-hmm. there are certain places you can't get to mm-hmm. surgically, mm-hmm. such as the bladder.
Mm-hmm. So possibly surgery, just depend on the extent of the endometriosis.
Exactly.
As to what you would do and if it was affecting the incontinence directly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very good. Well, we have covered a lot about the anatomy and physiology of urinary incontinence and symptoms and life cycles, where we are, and treatments and testing, urodynamic testing. Is there anything that you can think of in terms of symptoms or treatments that we've left out that you would want to share with the audience?
Well, I just like to emphasize, even though we made some of these things sound a little scary, I feel like people still are very hesitant to tell when they're having these problems. And with the newer medications, the newer, less invasive treatments, I just really encourage anybody who's affecting what they do. If you stop doing what you want to do, I've had a triathlete who just thanks us every day that she's able to do what she normally does again. If you're used to working out all the time and you don't because you're embarrassed or it's keeping you from doing that, or you're having to wear some type of pads that aren't very convenient, or you're having to stop along a race and go to the bathroom, I would say please mention it to your physician or come see us, because there are so many things now that we can do, you know, and we'll let the patient decide how aggressive they want to get and start out with the testing to kind of see what would be the most appropriate for
them. Yeah, and I would agree with you that although a lot of people don't know about urodynamic testing, it sounds like in a couple of hours you get the answers you need on an outpatient basis.
Right.
That could totally change your life. So embarrassed or not, you have one incident compared to many, many, many incidents.
Right.
Without intervention, that's one way to look at it. I wanted to also talk about, you mentioned the story about the triathlete, and I appreciate that. And I know that the listeners and the patients out there will remember stories. So are there any, like your triathlete, any other success stories that come to mind?
Yeah, you know, one lady in particular, her daughter thanks us all the time because she had severe overactive bladder, urge incontinence, several accidents a day, and she was wheelchair bound. So her daughter was having to get up all these times during the night and during the day. And then her bottom was getting quite irritated mm-hmm. from all of the wetness. And, you know, the caregivers really can benefit a lot from it as well. And it's really changed their life, both of their lives, quite a bit to have her go from 10 accidents today to one a week, you know.
I would think just couples. I mean, you've mentioned a couple of lifestyle things, like if you're stopping something that you enjoy doing together, if you were runners and you can't run, if you did whatever, it affects both people. Not
sure.
Just one, so.
Mm-hmm.
Any new treatments coming out that you're excited about? You mentioned the Botox. Is there anything else that's looking very promising in this area?
Well, there's different, you know, collagen injections in the neck and the bladder that are looking successful, as well as the Botox injections. There's a lot of medications on the rise. Even the InterStim neuromodulator, the battery is getting, they're going through a trial right now. And now it's, right now it looks like a pacemaker for the heart, that size. Now it's going to be more like a piece of dentine gum. So it's going to be, you know, there's a lot of like changes. There's some talk about an external stimulator where it's almost sticks on like a sticky pad on your lower back mm-hmm. that may be even less invasive, not requiring any leads or wires. So there's a lot of things on the horizon that I'm excited about.
Okay, very good. Sounds like like usual with medicine, you just got to keep up, and who knows what the next thing is. There might be something just for you. Well, believe it or not, we're to the end of the show. I want to thank you for being here today. And before we leave, I'd like to hear a little bit more about your practice in particular. You've mentioned Dr. Dobson, but I know you have a lot of associates over there, and where you are, and then we'll tell them how they can reach you.
Okay, yeah, we're attached to Northside Hospital in the 980 Johnson Ferry Building, Suite 720. And, yeah, I'm a part of a group of seven. And Dr. Dobson, I, and a PA, Sally Brumbill, we're all just GYN only. And I'll have our little special things that we like to do that you can find on our website. But also of note, in the office, we have a great group of obstetricians that do a lot of high-risk OB as well as other benign GYN. Dr. Winnie Sufi is the head doctor in that group, who's probably been here the longest, as well as Phoebe Sun, Karen Creed, and John Ehrlich. And they do an awesome job, you know, and at the baby factory of Northside. Mm-hmm. And so we'd love for anybody who needs any women's health in general to come out and see us.
Right. So that's Women's Health Associates. And let's give them the phone number over to the office.
It's 404-252-3898. And our website address is whaatlanta.com.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We hope to have you back in the future to maybe talk about those GYN surgeries and robotic surgeries, or pick another topic. But we've enjoyed your time today. So thanks so much for coming.
Oh, thank you.
And for all of you out there, thanks for tuning in. And please check with our sponsor's website, www.healthgate.com. There might be something on there that could save you time and money with some of these top docs in town too. Atlanta, have a great afternoon. We'll talk to you next week. And thanks so much for tuning in.
The Doctor's Roundtable has been a production brought to you by HealthGate and Business Radio X. HealthGate is a groundbreaking website where board-certified doctors and specialists offer savings on out-of-pocket healthcare costs. For more information about HealthGate, please visit www.healthgate.com or call 404-692-5377. We hope you tune in next week, and thank you for listening.